You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 8:30, and we have with us, live in the studios, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Maria's done with her preparations now. This is good. Giving new meaning to the term green room.
Okay. No inside jokes.
A little inside joke.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, we're
but we are in a good mood. Yes.
Excellent. Well, let's milk that while we can. Would you perhaps be in a good mood because of this week's elections?
Well, that's certainly one of the reasons. It was mixed, certainly. I mean, having Gene Godden on the city council is going to be a nightmare, as we were saying before we went on air. Having an incompetent person with all the wrong instincts in terms of Godden is actually a slight improvement over having an extremely competent person with all the wrong instincts, which was Margaret Pagler, who is, I'm sure, already lined up employment for one of the many people for whom she carried water during her 12 years on council. But much of the other, and of course Compton remains on council, which is, you know, there's not much you can do about that given who he was running against, but it was still cause for alarm. But one of the things that was very striking to me was that the media coverage of the election on Tuesday night was all about the anti-incumbent mood and what message it sent. Well, there wasn't really that much of an ideological message in the city council races. I mean, even if you look at the winners, Tom Rasmussen and David Della and Gene Godden, they're all people who've been rubbing elbows with, you know, political elites in this city for a long time, and in some cases taking studious notes on their new haircuts and what they serve at their cocktail parties. But that was very different from what happened in the school board race. And the school board race, I thought, was of interest not just for who lost but who won. It was really really kind of a textbook example of, if you want to start a grassroots revolution in this country, how it's got to happen. You have four people challenging for board seats, three of them up against incumbents, all of whom won, three of them with over 60% of the vote, the fourth one with 56% in Breida Butler-Walb, Darlene Flynn, Sally Soriano, and Irene Stewart. And the four women who did not know each other before the primary began became a slate based on their common criticisms of the school board, but they all ran very, very grassroots campaigns. You know, they had some people that they would run ideas past, but all of the central people in the campaigns, you know, basically we're not at all used to rubbing elbows with political elites in this city. You had Darlene Flynn was her own campaign manager, Butler Wall's campaign. Most of the central people in it, I think, were Green Party people. And you know, you look at the days where the Green Party was claiming a city council majority, but this really was the first time that the Green Party has been central in a citywide electoral victory. You have Sally Soriano, who was best known before this for her fair trade and WTO organizing work, which is not exactly a resume builder among editorial boards in this city, or the public for that matter, for much of it. It really was a case of people with a clear mandate for reform, with a clear idea that they want to put in accountability, transparency, and a very different way of running a large urban school district into place. They'll have a 5 of 7-person majority on the school board now, with a clear mandate for change.
And with a union contract coming up, they've got to negotiate with the teachers' union.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to in a minute. They, in many ways, winning the election was one of the easiest things that they will do, because they have a huge number of problems facing them now as a school board and as a district. They have the contract coming up. They have, obviously, the Wassel test kicking in, and that creates a number of urgent problems. They have the ongoing problems with disproportionality, which Darlene Flynn in particular hammered on during her campaign. You know, a lot of different things that are going to be a challenge, and, you know, all of the constituencies that were alienated with the past leadership and who adored these folks, well, they haven't cast their first vote yet, and as soon as they start casting their votes, the honeymoon will probably be off. But it really was exciting to to watch those campaigns come together. Several of them were very, very well run from the grassroots level and, you know, got very little media coverage in this city and still managed to pull off something that progressives in Seattle have not pulled off citywide in a very long time. It was really, really pretty exciting and joyous to see.
Mm. Yeah, I kind of got a kick out of the editorials prior to the election saying, you know, sticking with a lot of the incumbents for the school board, saying that they had this institutional memory, you know, that would be lost with the new people. And I was just thinking, well, they haven't accessed that memory in the last, you know, five, you know, years or so.
Well,
so
memories can be good memories and bad memories.
Very bad memories, yeah. It's like, why would you want to remember all of the ways that they've done things that have been disastrous?
Yeah, would you want to access those terrible nightmare memories of the former board, so...
So, anything else on the elections that you want to...
Yeah, did you want to kick in with any?
No, that's fine.
Okay. All right. Well, let's jump off to international issues, which is, I think, the bulk of what we have left here. What shall we start with? How about Afghanistan? You don't catch a lot of news.
Oh, yeah, the war. That one.
There's another war going on, folks. But this week, Afghanistan got a new constitution. Now, I've had a chance to read the new Afghanistan constitution, and it's interesting because the constitution was supposed to have been made public earlier in the year, sometime around June or July, and then there were going to be 3 months or so when the public in Afghanistan could make comments on the new constitution, and then the Loya Jirga is supposed to convene in December in order to make changes, make amendments based on suggestions from the public in Afghanistan, and then vote on the new constitution as to whether or not they're going to actually have one and what it's going to be. Now, what's happened with this process is back in June, they were still making changes to it, the group that was drafting the Constitution, and they didn't make it public. In fact, they kept making announcements, well, we will make it public soon. It's going to be made public in the next week or two. It'll be made public next month. It'll be made public in August. It'll be made public in late September. Well, here it is. It's the first week of November, and finally we've been able to see a draft of the new Afghan constitution, and it's only less than a month before the Loya Jirga convenes. And in all that time, the public has been able to give testimony, but they haven't been able to read the draft constitution, so they have no idea what it is they were really supposed to be critiquing. So now what it's coming down to is the constitution, which has been a big state secret up until now, is now public, and there's not much time for people in Afghanistan to read it and to make comments on it and to try to influence the Loya Jirga. Now, reading the new constitution, I have to say that there is definitely no separation of church and state. It provides for, in Article Number 1, actually begins, Afghanistan is an Islamic republic. Article Number 2, it begins, the religion of Afghanistan is the sacred religion of Islam. Now, that article goes on to say that other religions are allowed, but they're not the state religion. Article number 3,
This is sounding a lot like the Taliban, actually.
Yeah, these are the first three articles of the Constitution. They're not Article 33 or Article 15 or something. These are Article 1, 2, and 3. Article 3 says that, basically summarizing it, says that in Afghanistan, no law can be contrary to the sacred religion of Islam and the values of the Constitution. So while they're not saying in these first three articles that Afghanistan is going to be under Sharia law, which is what the Taliban used, they are leaving the door wide open for that later, particularly in a Loya Jirga that may be dominated by Islamic fundamentalists.
And at a time when the Taliban themselves is very much making a comeback.
Yeah. Now, there are some other troublesome articles to the Constitution, too. The calendar of the country shall be based on the pilgrimage of the Prophet, of which this year is year number 1382, which is why when you pick up the draft Constitution and you look at it, it says drafted in the year 1382 on it. Now, that same article says that for state purposes, they'll use the regular calendar that everybody else does, but it, again, institutionalizes Islam as a part of the government.
Although that is actually very common in the Islamic world and also in other countries that have different religions as well. You see that in Japan, for example, all the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, Article number 35 allows the formation of political parties, but they have to not be contrary to the principles of Islam. So that in itself is going to be a big problem. You can, if say, for example, you want to have a socialist party, that might be contrary to the laws of Islam. So that could open the door for political repression down the line. There's also no article that ensures women's rights, but there is one that that says, quote, family is a fundamental unit of society and is supported by the state. Now, you might wonder why that has to be in there and what that leaves the door open for, too. Now, and also as a woman, I kind of read that as saying, especially since that article goes on to say the state adopts necessary measures to ensure physical and psychological well-being of the family, especially of the child and mother, the upbringing of children, and the elimination of traditions contrary to the principles of the sacred religion of Islam. Now, to me, as a woman reading that and not seeing an article that ensures women's rights, basically is saying, well, women, this is what your role in society is going to be, and it's going to be enforced by law. You wear the veil, and you raise children, and you stay home.
Yeah, and I also see that, and this has something to do with my background also. I see that as a law that leaves wide open for the same sort of status that homosexuals had under the Taliban, mm-hmm. which basically was punishable by death.
Right, right. And then there's one more thing about the Constitution that bugs me and should bug other people as well, is it provides for a National Assembly, which would be kind of like our version of Congress, and it also provides for the loya jirga, something that is a traditional function of Afghan society. Now, in Article 81, it says the National Assembly of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan is the highest legislative organ and is a manifestation of the will of its people and represents the whole nation. So it's saying that the National Assembly is the highest body in the state. However, Article 110 goes on and says the loya jirga is the highest manifestation of the people of Afghanistan. You might think there's a little bit of a conflict there. Now, it also says that the loya jirga gets convened and can be convened for three reasons, and one of those reasons is to take decision on the issues related to independence, national sovereignty, territorial integrity, and supreme interests of the country. That's pretty vague. In fact, that's so vague that the loya jirga could be convened for almost any reason. When you look at what the composition of the loya jirga is, it's going to consist of the National Assembly plus the chairpersons of the provincial and district councils. In other words, people who owe their allegiance to local warlords and militias. You start to get a little bit nervous if it includes elected folks and folks who are also not elected but owe their allegiance to local warlords. You start to get a little bit nervous about how the loya jirga might be misused.
All right. So how long do people then in Afghanistan have to comment on this?
They have less than a month to read it and comment on it.
And then what was the role of Washington in sort of developing or overseeing the Constitution?
Well, the UN was supposedly helping with drafting the Constitution, but there's no doubt that there were a large number of U.S. advisors. And the Constitution does resemble our Constitution quite a bit. It does provide for a lot of the same rights that we have in the U.S. Constitution, although it's worded quite differently, probably because there were some cultural things that they had to incorporate into the Constitution as well.
Okay. Well, let's move along. Talk about Iraq, this week in Iraq.
Okay.
Jump to that.
Try to be fast with this. This has been...
If you can.
Yeah. I mean, you could just start reading the list of things that have gone wrong this week, and it'd take the rest of the half hour.
I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give you some statistics, though. 32 U.S. troops have died this week in Iraq, plus two U.S. civilian contractors working for the Army Corps of Engineers, plus one Polish military officer, plus one British Royal Marine. So that's some 36 or more people, and that's not including Iraqis who have died. Also, three Iraqi judges were killed, Two were executed, one kidnapped and shot, and one shot in a drive-by shooting. Both of those judges, one in Najaf and one in Mosul, have been responsible for trying former Baathists, former members of Saddam Hussein's regime. And then a third judge was killed in Kirkuk by U.S. military soldiers who were lying in ambush waiting for someone that they thought was going to stage an attack. And it turns out that this judge and his brother drove into this ambush and were shot and killed. So there's definitely been a number of Iraqi civilians targeted this week as well.
Which we're not hearing a whole lot about in the media coverage.
We are not at all. No, mortars were fired at U.S. Central Headquarters in Baghdad for two nights in a row. And there were many, many other attacks as well, including mortars fired at the U.S. headquarters in Mosul, which is Iraq's third largest city. Now, Paul Bremer, in response to all this, has finally given his okay for the creation of an Iraqi paramilitary force under the control of the interim interior minister. Now, that force is going to be made up of former members of Iraq's security services, and with no doubt there will be members of the dreaded Mukhabarat, who will be members of that force, and also members of the political party militias, including Ahmed Chalabi's thugs. These guys will have broad powers to conduct raids and interrogate suspects, which means exactly what you think it will mean. They're setting up death squads now who will have the ability to torture people. Now, I don't think this is an adequate or a good response to what's going on. In fact, I think it will make things worse, particularly when it's coming from a man, Paul Bremer, who had the bright idea to disband the Iraqi military in the first place so that they could all go home with their weapons and reconstitute themselves as these guerrilla cells to attack
and
U.S.
And
troops.
With no money, since they weren't getting paid and didn't get their back pay.
Right. There's another danger when you legitimize these political party militias. You are setting yourself up for a situation in Afghanistan, situation similar to what's going on in Afghanistan, where you have local militias controlled by local warlords who are fighting each other and creating a civil war type situation. And then finally, I want to talk about there was a great article in the Washington Post on Friday, just yesterday, that said that of the 60,400 Iraqi policemen now on the job, only about 4,000 of them have been through the U.S.-run police training course. The rest of them are learning on the job, which is why you get situations like you had this past weekend in Baghdad, where Iraqi police were blamed for shooting into a group of people protesting the U.S. Troops taking down an open-air market in an area of Baghdad that's been not very friendly to U.S. troops. And you've had other reports of Iraqi police firing into crowds of demonstrators as well. Well, that's because these guys are learning on the job. That's how urgent it is for the U.S. to get Iraqi police on the job so U.S. troops can come home. They're basically hiring anybody who comes along. Security checks have not been adequately done. And they're getting people who just don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, and you also have an article, I believe it was in the New York Times this morning, that's talking about how the U.S. is starting to rely more and more on former people who are police officers, security personnel during the Saddam Hussein regime.
Yes.
Not just unintentionally because they don't do the security checks, but intentionally going and recruiting these people as well.
Mm-hmm. Because they have some experience. Now, there are plenty of people in the Iraqi police who are being hired who used to just be drivers and office clerks who have had never worn a gun and have had no experience at all on the street. Those guys are being put out on patrol. That's not a good situation.
So the 60,000, is that part of the, what is on the news this week, the 250,000 troops that the U.S. is proposing pulling, you know, creating in Iraq of Iraqis?
You know, it's part that? Of the. It's part. I've seen another statistic. Part of the 100,000 or so police and private security forces that are supposed to be on the job by now. Now, 36,000 Iraqi guards. There are about 36,000 Iraqi guards who are not Iraqi police, but they're private security guards are guarding public facilities, including these pipelines that keep getting oil pipelines that keep getting sabotaged and public buildings and so forth. And those guys only get maybe a couple of days training. They don't get much training either, and I'm betting they're not getting much security screening either.
Now, also this week, didn't Turkey make clear that they're
sending in? They are not sending any troops to Iraq because the Kurds don't want them.
Yeah, and it was...
Which could have been predicted. It's a big slap in the face for the U.S. because both Turkey and the European Union are mad at the U.S. saying, why did you even propose Turkish troops go in? You didn't even ask the Kurds in Iraq if they wanted them. It's just so obvious that you should have.
Yeah, and it also represents the last of the outstanding requests by the Bush administration for foreign service personnel. So, you know, this widely ballyhooed drive to recruit foreign troops is basically over now.
Has been almost nothing
to show for it.
Has been an absolute failure.
So they also announced this week that they're going to grab another 43,000 National Guardsmen from across the U.S. Mm-hmm. to ship them over.
That's right, and there's been rumors of a new draft being reinstituted. I think it's going to have to come down to that because there's no foreign troops that are going to go in there. They're not going to be able to train Iraqi troops fast enough, and we don't have the forces currently in the volunteer army. So it's going to eventually come down to a draft unless there's some major policy change that brings the troops home, and I don't see that happening.
Yeah, and I saw in a debate, one of the Democratic debates this week, that three of the contenders have given a big thumbs up for adding 18-year-old women into that potential draft. So,
yeah. And you have...
Lovely.
I'm being besieged with email now for a column that I have both on the Weekly and working for Change.com that went through what the Democratic presidential hopefuls have to say on the web about where to go now in Iraq. Kucinich is the only one out of the nine who is actually talking about withdrawing U.S. troops and giving... And most of the rest of them, you know, actually dodged the subject. But many of these folks are focusing on criticizing Bush, but are very, very reluctant to give specifics of what they would do in Iraq.
Wesley Clark just this week made a proposal that involved bringing in the UN and having the UN control things based on his experience in the Balkans. Although I'm not sure exactly how practical that was and whether or not that's gonna go over too well with voters, given that Wesley Clark was kicked out of his job in the Balkans.
Yes. Although most voters, I don't think, realize that. But
yeah, that's true.
All right. Let's move along. To Palestine-Israel. They have a large wall that's going up there.
Tomorrow has been called by a number of Palestinian groups in Palestine, as well as their support groups around the world and groups that work on Palestine issues around the world, as an international day of protest. That actually, for a change, when you hear that phrase, it actually is international, and it actually is a day of protest. And that will include here in Seattle at 2 o'clock at Westlake downtown. To protest the erection of what is widely being called an apartheid wall, that Israel is erecting this enormous wall, both in Gaza Strip and West Bank, to keep the occupied territories, which are, you know, let's remind ourselves once again, do not actually legally belong to Israel. The areas have been under military occupation for 37 years, to keep the undesirables out of Israel proper. And this is one of the one of the many steps that's been quietly taken, particularly under the Ariel Sharon government, but also in recent years predating that, to try and tighten security in Israel at the expense of the daily lives of Palestinians. It really is reminiscent of nothing so much not so much the Berlin Wall, and the demonstration was called to on the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. That's the symbolism behind choosing tomorrow as a day to protest. But this wall is actually much longer and much larger than the Berlin Wall, much larger physically. It's wider. It's I think twice as tall. The idea for it actually came out of the conservatives who have clamored for and partially succeeded in getting built on the Mexican border with California, an enormous wall to keep the Mexicans out. The difference here, of course, was that, you know, the U.S. illegally seized and then settled territory 150 years ago or 155 years ago, whereas Israel only did it a generation ago. But it really is this idea that that you can control people by building walls. It's a really really kind of frightening symbolism as well as a reality Israel has been trying very hard to add daily difficulties and humiliations to the life of Palestinians as part of their control strategy.
Isn't there now some talk within the Israeli cabinet itself, as well as among the Israeli military, about how some of these tactics that are being used to humiliate the Palestinians are just going way too far?
Yeah,
and it's
very
creating
much, so.
Much more of a problem. That's creating many more radicals among Palestinian youth in particular.
Very, very much so. In fact, a memorial service for Yitzhak Rabin, which is held on the anniversary of his assassination each year, was held last week in Tel Aviv, and it basically turned into a rally against the Sharon government, which was not originally supposed to be, drew over 100,000 people, the largest anti-Sharon rally since that
mostly
government started.
Israelis.
Mostly, almost entirely Israelis. Uh-huh. And you have a much wider and much more vigorous debate over these topics in Israel than you do in the United States. And one of the reasons I brought up the Mexican wall is that both in Israel and here and in the Islamic world, the actions of the Sharon government are being seen as taking their cue from the United States. And it's not just the enormous amount of money that we put in. It's that the Sharon government has been able to push the envelope in a way unimaginable to previous Israeli governments because they've had permission from the Bush administration. Because the White House
has
said,
aren't we sending the economic aid too? Because
yes.
Israel's been under a very bad recession for the last 3 or 4 years
because
of the Intifada.
Because of the Intifada, because they've made it so difficult for Palestinians to work, and one of the bases of the occupation and of Israel Palestinian politics is that Israel uses Palestinians as a cheap labor force.
Yeah,
both the actual citizens and people from Gaza and the West Bank.
Yeah, it's also impacted tourism, which has been a big industry for Israel as well. Religious tourists who want to come and visit the Holy Land have stayed away. You don't want to go and get shot, naturally.
Yeah, it's
plus there are a lot of places that are simply off limits because of the building the wall and the occupation itself. People want to visit some of these towns that are Palestinian towns, and they can't.
Yeah, and it's a grim situation, and there are proposals within Israel itself for better ways to be dealing with it, but the political reality is that the Sharon government is not likely to change without pressure from the White House, from the Bush administration, and that means folks like us turning out at demonstrations like this, and in general making it more of a political priority.
That's right.
So that's 2:00 tomorrow at Westlake Park.
It absolutely is.
And a couple other things happening this week?
Yeah, a couple things happening this coming week Tuesday. Brian Wilson, who is a name that many people may remember, not from the Beach Boys, but the demonstrator in the 1980s who actually lost his legs to a train at Concord Naval Air Station protesting Central American policies. Been a very outspoken peace activist for a number of years. He will be in town. He'll be at Kane Hall on Tuesday night, and then he'll also be over in Bellevue, I believe, the next day at the Bradford Center in Bellevue from 7 to 9 on the 12th.
I'm going to have an interview with him tomorrow morning.
Oh, great. And then what time tomorrow morning?
I'm not sure yet if it's at 7 or 7:30. You
okay.
Know
how
that
well, you just have to listen to both.
Is.
Yep.
Yeah, you want to tune in for that. That'll
yep.
be good.
And then also on Wednesday night, a panel which Ross Reynolds from KOW will be moderating and that I'll be on also, called The Politics of Fear, that is being organized by one of the neighborhood snow groups, the Magnolia Peace Project. That'll be at Magnolia Lutheran Church at 2414 31st Avenue West in Magnolia, again at 7:00 on Wednesday night. And some other very good panelists and guests also.
All right. Well, he can try his hand at, keeping you within bounds there.
Nobody's done it yet.
I try.
Well, okay, one person.
All right. Well, with that, we're pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
I'll let you do it.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you find free publications. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.com. eatthestate.org. That's eatthestate, all one word, .org. And if you want to volunteer, you have questions, tips, comments, you've got a great lead on a story, you work for somebody that we think is really, really bad, and you have a great thing that happened to you at work you want to pass on or something, you can give us a call at 206-903-9461. And again, don't tell me I should go to Iraq, because Baghdad International Airport is not open for commercial flights.